The world changed in 2022, as we know, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russia's oil and gas customers stopped buying its products, and that has redrawn the world energy map. Where's it going? Global oil analyst Dan Yergin joins us. He is vice chairman of S&P Global. 3 decades ago, Dan Yergin won a Pulitzer for his book, The Prize, a kind of history map of energy. His recent book is The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. Dan Yergin, good to have you back.
Thank you, Scott.
So let's start with Ukraine, where we know the Russian invasion took the old map of world energy and kind of crumpled it up. Let's first talk about oil. How does that change where Russian oil goes?
It's a dramatic change. Europe was Russia's main market for oil, and Putin counted on it and just assumed that that would continue. But the Europeans have banned the import of Russian oil. And led by the United States, there's also a price cap on Russian oil, which Putin never expected. And so Russian oil now is going to India, which never imported Russian oil before, and China primarily, and it's shut out of what was its main market.
And of course, there's natural gas, which is critical for heating in the world, notably in Europe this winter. Europe has turned its back on natural gas, at which point Moscow said, well, we didn't want to send it to you anyway. What is the emerging map of natural gas in the world?
There, it's really dramatic because actually it was Putin who basically he laid out a strategy last June in which he said, you'll drive up the price of natural gas, create economic hardship, bring populist parties and social turmoil, and left unsaid, break the coalition. He assumed that that would work because Europe was so dependent on Russian gas, but Europe has shown that it, with great difficulty and with economic pain, can do without. So Russian gas is no longer, most of Russian gas is no longer flowing to Europe. And indeed now, something that would not have been imagined in January of 2022 is that U.S. exports of U.S. liquefied natural gas have now become one of the foundations for European energy security. That is such a big change.
Let me ask you, Dan Yergin, about the consumer, say the petroleum car driver around the world. Longer term, what are the implications of all of this? Many analysts think oil prices will stay relatively high for a while.
I think that what we've really seen is that prices are volatile. They go up and down. Prices are a lot lower than they were several months ago, than people expected them to be. Part of that is because of the Federal Reserve, which probably is having the biggest impact of anything on oil prices right now by slowing the U.S. economy and central banks slowing other economies. So I think for now we're in a period where oil prices are still higher than normal, but they're not what they were a few months ago when it looked very difficult. But there's a big wild card out there, and that wild card is called China, because oil demand, global oil demand has been down because Chinese oil demand has been down because of the COVID lockdown and now the COVID chaos in China. If China comes back, that could tighten the oil market again. But for right now, the picture, certainly for anybody who's filling up his or her tank, is a lot better than it seemed to be several months ago.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, at least for now, still on the relatively higher side, for the energy transition away from fossil fuels, isn't this kind of what proponents want? That is, if oil in general gets more expensive, suddenly the alternatives get more economically competitive.
I think that's true. I think even while we've had a return of energy security and a new focus on assuring that there's enough oil supply, after all, you have the Biden administration actually telling U.S. oil companies, could you produce more oil? At the same time, you have things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which are putting so much money into renewables and alternatives and hydrogen and carbon capture, that accelerates the energy transition, even at the same time as energy security looms larger than it did a year ago.
Well, that brings us to talk a little bit more about China. In your book, you write about several new maps emerging in the world, the changing Middle East map and the changing China map. And assuming, as most people do, that China's influence will continue to grow through its alliances around the world, its Belt and Road Initiative, does that amplify everything China, that is, a China that still needs fossil fuels to bring hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, and also a China that is a world leader in solar, in batteries, in electric vehicles.
Scott, what you've described is an all-of-the-above China. In its latest 14th five-year plan, it links energy security and low carbon together. And for China, growing energy demand is a very big issue. China imports 75% of its oil, which they regard as a big security risk and part of the larger U.S.-China great power competition that I write about in the new map. But they've also, you know, half the wind, half the solar's there. And China has established a very predominant position in the supply chains for a low-carbon future, if you're talking about electric car batteries and so forth. And I think one other thing that people will be surprised about is that China has had as early commitment as Tesla to the electric car. And China now looks to compete in the electric car market around the world as an exporter. And I think that's been their strategy now for a number of years since they realized they couldn't compete with conventional cars, but with their position and their domestic market, the base of that, they can be very competitive in electric cars, and cheap Chinese electric cars are already appearing in showrooms in Europe.
Well, many analysts who think about these big questions say the energy transition is already happening. You think so as well, but I gather you think this transition may go more slowly than others are predicting, or more slowly than others want. What are the limiting factors in your view?
I think what gets left out of the discussion are the 80% of the people who live in the developing world who are in a very different position. For them, per capita incomes may be 1/20th of what it is in Europe or the United States, and they believe they need conventional energy. Best example is India. On the one hand, there's a huge commitment to renewables, a big commitment to hydrogen, but they're also building a $60 billion natural gas transmission system. And for people in the developing world to go from burning firewood to what's called liquid petroleum gas, that's their energy transition. So I think it's more complicated, and I think there is something of a north-south divide now.
Yeah. So you take all these complicated factors you write about in your book and these many maps that are changing. So let me ask you to project. I mean, you're in the projection business to some degree. When do you think the world's use of oil will peak, unless we're already there? And when do you think the world's use of gas will peak?
I think world oil demand will probably peak in the early 2030s, and natural gas probably a decade after that. It's still going to take a lot of investment when that happens, because every year oil fields decline by about 5%. So there's still a lot of investment that will be required. So when I look out, I see renewables having a much bigger share of a much bigger energy pie, but oil and gas being part of it. And that's what makes what's called carbon capture also an important part of the equation. And that's one of the things that the United Nations have emphasized in their reports, that you're going to need carbon capture, because oil and gas will be part of the energy mix, just not as big a part.
Yeah. And by that, you mean these still emerging efforts as far as carbon capture, to capture carbon emissions coming out of big smokestacks and finding a way to store it somewhere, stick it underground, or that kind of thing. And finally, Dan Juergen, just on the issue of projecting and predicting, you're bold to be in that space. In your book, The Prize, the book that came out in the early 90s, you predicted we will be an oil society much longer than we thought. How well do you think that prediction has aged?
I would amend it to say that oil and gas will be part of the energy mix, but they'll be a less dominant part as we go forward. I think that's the change.
That's Dan Juergen, global energy analyst, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, whose new book is The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. Dan Juergen, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
And thank you, Scott.